This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd. A panel of outside advisors to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has recommended emergency use of Moderna's coronavirus vaccine. We get more from AP's Mike Gracia.
A second COVID-19 vaccine has been endorsed by a government advisory panel. After 7 hours of debate over technical details, the Food and Drug Administration advisory panel has voted 20-0 with one abstention to greenlight the vaccine from Moderna and the National Institutes of Health. Panel member Dr. Paul Offit.
We can feel pretty comfortable that this vaccine is going to have a benefit that lasts for more than the 3 months or so that we studied it.
The FDA is expected to grant emergency use authorization for the Moderna vaccine quickly. Vaccinations with the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine began earlier this week in the U.S. Mike Gracia, Washington.
President-elect Joe Biden has tested negative for the coronavirus after one of his closest advisors tested positive for COVID-19. The Biden transition team says Representative Cedric Richmond of Louisiana tested positive 2 days after attending a Democratic campaign rally in Atlanta, Georgia, headlined by Biden. The rally was for Georgia Senate candidates John Ossoff and the Reverend Raphael Warnock. In a statement, Biden transition spokesperson Kate Bedingfield says Richmond was not in close contact with the president-elect. Richmond is set to resign from Congress to join the Biden administration as a senior advisor. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits rose again last week to 885,000, the highest weekly total since September, as a resurgence of coronavirus cases threatens the economy's recovery from its springtime collapse. Before the coronavirus erupted in March, weekly jobless claims had typically numbered about 225,000. This is VOA News. 344 boys were released Thursday after being abducted last week by Boko Haram from their school in northern Nigeria. Timothy Ubiezu reports from Abuja.
Secretary to the Katsina State Governor Mustafa Inua broke the news of the release of the boys Thursday, accompanied by nationwide jubilations. The boys, who were found in the neighboring state of Zamfara, will be transported home to Katsina on Friday, authorities say. Earlier Thursday, Boko Haram released a video of the students saying they did not want to be rescued. Following last Friday's kidnapping, states in northern Nigeria, including Kaduna, Kano, Jigawa, and Zamfara, shut down their schools over fears of another attack. Last Friday's attack on the school in Katsina is the worst in 6 years. Boko Haram has been waging a war against Western education in northeastern Nigeria since 2009, but has recently expanded its operations to other regions of the country. Timothy Ubiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Wearing a white medical mask, French President Emmanuel Macron went ahead with a planned speech by video conference Thursday, hours after testing positive for COVID-19 following a week in which he met with numerous European leaders. We get more from Reuters' Maha Abdeldraoui.
In a statement made on Thursday, the president's office said the diagnosis was, quote, made following a PCR test performed at the onset of the first symptoms. The 42-year-old will self-isolate for the next 7 days, but, his LSA office added, he will continue to work and carry out duties remotely. In addition, in the last 2 weeks, Macron has met with numerous world leaders, including the prime ministers of Portugal and Spain, Egypt's president, and attended a summit that included the heads of state of Germany, Italy, Belgium, and the EU chief, among others. Prime Minister Jean Castex will also self-isolate after coming into contact with Macron over the last few days.
That's Reuters' Maha Abdeldraoui. U.S. authorities are expressing increased alarm over a hack of government computer systems worldwide. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
Officials suspect Russia was behind the sophisticated hack of government agencies, including the Treasury and Commerce Departments. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency says the intrusion poses a, quote, grave risk to federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial governments, plus critical infrastructure entities and the private sector. The agency warns it'll be hard to remove the malware inserted through network software. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, December 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian security forces rescue more than 300 kidnapped students.
I called the governor and he confirmed to me that all the students, 344 in number, have been released to government and that these students will be transported to Katsina from Zamfara in the bush under a heavy escort.
Today is International Migrants Day and we'll focus on Africa. We'll examine an alternative rite of passage for Tanzanian girls. And three Cameroonian soldiers accused of killing villagers have gone on trial in a military court.
We call for a public trial where all participants can feel safe and comfortable that their security will be guaranteed.
And cutting-edge agricultural technology to help African farmers produce more food. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian security forces have rescued more than 300 students who were abducted from an all-boys government science school in the country's Katsina state. Governor Aminu Bello Masari said he believed most of the boys had been recovered. The Islamist militant group Boko Haram had claimed responsibility for the abduction. On the line from Kaduna is VOA's Hausa service reporter Sani Malumfashi.
Actually, this evening, around 8:30 or thereabout, I called the governor when he confirmed to me that all the students had been released to government and that these students will be transported to Katsina from Zamfara in the bush under a heavy escort.
How did they free the students?
This is a question that they wouldn't want to disclose on air to anybody, maybe at a later stage. But for now, they won't tell you whether they have given money or not. All they were happy to tell journalists who, you know, interview them or contact them is just to tell them that we have secured the release of the students, 344 in number.
I'm wondering if they were able to secure the release of the children, they must know who the kidnappers are.
Yeah, from all indications, Boko Haram released a video film showing the children the way they did for the Chibok girls and those of Dapchi when they, you know, abducted them. So that was the way they did. In fact, in the afternoon when they released the video, one of them was saying, we just want to disprove the state governor who said it is not Boko Haram, it is the bandits. And here are they, see us with them here. Then it was later on that now they come. So it's purely Boko Haram that abducted the students.
I spoke with Shehu Galba, the president's communication advisor, yesterday, and he mentioned that negotiations were going on. I'm wondering, was there any ransom in order to get the children released?
Basically, what I know happened is that definitely there could be a kind of ransom, maybe in kind, because I knew when Katsina State enter into that kind of a dialogue with the Fulani bandits, what they did was to request that all our people now in prison and police custody be released. That is the only thing we want. Then we can assure you that we are putting down all our arms. This is exactly what they did around September, October last year. That was the deal they struck for a stay of action. When they stepped down for nearly 2-3 months, there wasn't any problem of any kidnapping or killing. It was later they now resumed hostilities in their own way.
It seems the federal government has come under criticism because of this latest abduction. I was reading the former president, Olusegun Obasanjo, also criticizing the security situation. What are you hearing from Nigerians with this latest kidnapping of children?
In fact, Nigerians are baffled with the continued insecurity in Nigeria across the board. Most of them were saying, look, it's high time the service chiefs retired and the new ones they appointed since they have failed the country security-wise. In fact, most of them have overstayed their years of service in the Nigerian Armed Forces.
Sunny, thank you very much. We're so happy to speak with you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you for having me.
Sunny Malumfashi, a reporter for VOA's Hausa service, was speaking with us from Kaduna City, Nigeria. In Cameroon, three soldiers were in court on Thursday, accused of killing villagers, including women and children, while fighting separatists. Cameroon's government initially denied any military blame for the February killings, but prosecuted the troops later under international and rights group pressure. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé.
A few civilians were at the military tribunal in Yaoundé Thursday to witness the trial of the three soldiers accused of the February 14 Garbu massacre of women and children. Gabriel Foyong says he lost two family members and wants to see justice served.
We are not asking for something much from the government of Cameroon. What we require is just justice, that justice should take its rightful course so that such incidents may be avoided. Honestly, government needs to sit up because most of the people dying are the innocent ones. Garbu is a very perfect example.
The defendants pleaded not guilty before the session was adjourned. The presiding judge at the military tribunal, Yvonne Leopoldine Akwa, did not say when the proceedings will resume. Human Rights Watch describes the Garbu killings as one of the worst incidents of abuse by the security forces in the history of Cameroon's separatist crisis. The rights group says 17 members of a vigilante group and a separatist fighter are also charged and remain at large. Ilaria Alegrozi, senior Central African researcher for Human Rights Watch, says the trial is expected to be an important step toward tackling impunity.
We call for a public trial where all participants can feel safe and comfortable that their security will be guaranteed. And this will be key to really help end the cycles of violence and impunity that have affected the Anglophone regions for the past 4 years.
Human Rights Watch said 21 civilians, including 13 children and a pregnant woman, were killed. 5 houses were torched. Property was looted and some residents beaten. Alegrozi says the killings and torture were not isolated cases, but part of a long history of military abuses in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. In a press release, government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi said the Central African State will make sure the trial is fair and that the accused are punished. Authorities initially denied that troops were responsible for the massacre, describing the accusation as propaganda from separatists to discredit government forces. But following international pressure, Cameroon President Paul Biya ordered investigations. The Central African State later acknowledged troops were responsible. The government promised what it called a decent burial for the dead and to compensate the bereaved families. But Edward Faw, a member of the Ndonga Mantum Administrative Unit, where Garbu is located, says the government has not honored its promise.
I think a special commission should be created by legislation to actually look into this Garbu incident. The international community is watching. Those of us from the area are watching and listening. Placing a military base in Garbu doesn't solve the situation.
Armed groups have been fighting to create an independent state in the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions, separate from the rest of Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. Violence in the English-speaking regions since 2016 has claimed more than 3,000 lives and caused the displacement of more than 430,000 civilians, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Today is International Migrants Day, and the International Organization for Migration, the IOM, says at least more than 270 million people live in countries other than their own as migrants. The day has been celebrated since 2000 to shine the spotlight on the plight, rights, and contributions of migrants. The IOM says Africa hosts the fourth largest number of global migrants. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, the COVID-19 pandemic has severely impacted most migrants, rendering thousands of them jobless.
The International Organization for Migration says the reason why people move away from their countries of origin is mainly because of poverty and unemployment. And for these reasons, at least 272 million people live outside their countries of origin as migrants. Lydia Anyango is a Kenyan who moved to Egypt from Kenya on a tourist visa. And after it expired, she disappeared and stayed for more than 1 year working illegally as a house help in Egypt.
It was not easy staying there because we lived as if we were hiding. We were not confident because we knew we were not there legally. So I was arrested at the airport because my visa was a visitor's visa. They arrested me and took me inside. They threatened me to give them all the money I had or else they electrocute me. They took all the money, they harassed me, and they took me straight to the plane so that I wouldn't talk to anybody out there.
Migrants across the world contribute their knowledge, networks, and skills to build stronger and more resilient communities. Rose Kabusinzi is a Tanzanian living and doing business in Kenya. She says there is too much hassle living in Kenya since the business permits are short-term, and for one to get a longer one, you are either in school or married to a Kenyan. She, however, says Kenya is a good place to do business.
For people who decide to relocate to other country, there are some challenges obtaining living permit, especially for me. Sometimes you can get permit for a short time, like 3 month visa, and when it expires, you have to go back home for like 1 month and come back again. And if you need a permit for a long time, like 2 years, you have to be married there with a Kenyan. In general, most of foreigners living in Kenya access government services, same as Kenyan.
Just like many, migrants are as well affected by COVID-19. Through job losses, eviction, and discrimination. The regional communication spokesperson, International Organization for Migration in Kenya, Yvonne Ndege, said that most migrants have been affected greatly by the COVID-19 pandemic, which has led to most of them being displaced, lost jobs, and others lost lives.
We have recorded the deaths of migrants in the desert from thirst and from hunger and from dehydration. We also know that many migrants remain stranded. Tens of thousands of migrants remain stranded across Eastern Horn of Africa because of the impact of COVID-19, because nations have closed borders.
Millions of migrants are stranded, often without income or shelter, unable to return home due to COVID-19 mobility restrictions, and they also face increased risk of trafficking and exploitation. Yvonne says most of the migrant communities have not been able to contribute to social and economic growth of the countries they come from due to pandemic that led to job losses for most of them. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Milwaukee, USA.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, December 18. In Tanzania, female circumcision, better known as female genital mutilation, the FGM, is still practiced among some ethnic groups as a rite of passage into womanhood. Many girls are forced or coerced into FGM by their families to avoid being shunned and scarred for life. To bridge the gap between health and tradition, the healthcare nonprofit AMREF has been promoting an alternative rite of passage for girls. Charles Kumbe reports from Tanga, Tanzania.
Margaret Sendeu is 14 years old and says one of her worst memories was when, at the age of 11, she nearly bled to death when she was subjected to FGM. She says 9 of them were taken to the ceremonial house where a woman came and started cutting them. The teenager says they bled a lot. She also says some girls were taken to hospitals and others died. She adds that she did not want to go through the procedure and does not wish to see other girls undergoing the circumcision. More than 25% of girls and women have undergone FGM in Tanzania. In rural pastoral communities, many girls are forced to undergo FGM by their parents in the hopes of securing her dowry. Girls who have not gone through it are believed to be more promiscuous. Others are forced to do so in the name of tradition or risk being shunned in their villages. Maria Kunde is Margaret's mother. She says if a girl gets married without having been circumcised, according to Maasai tradition, it's a sin. She says if the husband finds out that the Maasai girl is not circumcised, he rejects her on the ground that she's still a young girl and not a woman. To end the brutal practice, healthcare non-profit AMREF introduced an alternative with safe traditional rituals to mark and celebrate a girl's initiation into womanhood. The group says more than 15,000 girls have avoided FGM. The AMREF Africa project manager, Aisha Bianuku, explains. Bianuku says, in the alternative passage of age, we follow all their traditions, but we add one segment, teaching the girls about reproductive health and their gender rights. Bianuku also says, we are celebrating together the rite of passage ceremony, but without circumcisions. We are planning to totally remove it. This was also a way to make a living for those who circumcise, by getting money and gifts. AMREF is now providing them with assistance in the form of loans. Among them, Martha Tumbo. Tumbo says when she circumcised a girl, she'll get one goat, which was equivalent of 50,000 shillings. But now, Tumbo says, she no longer circumcises. Although the practice is illegal in Tanzania, it takes place in secret in some communities. Faraja Kampambe is a social welfare officer.
Tunakoelekea tatizo linakwenda kupungua.
He says the problem is starting to decrease, but nowadays statistics show that some communities, especially the cow-based communities, have noticed that the government have been strong in fighting these acts. Kampambe adds that in some places, as soon as a girl is born, she is circumcised. Meanwhile, Margaret is celebrating in the same ceremonies that led her into FGM 3 years ago, but is now smiling as more than 450 girls of her age mark their coming of age without undergoing the traditional act. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Tanga, Tanzania.
According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, global climate change coupled with explosive population growth will threaten world food security over the coming decades. In Africa alone, the population is expected to double by 2050. That's why experts say that cutting-edge agricultural technology and satellite data must be made available to African farmers at little or no cost and in a form that is simple for non-specialists to use. To find out more about what is and can be done in the area, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with André Laperriere, Executive Director of the Global Open Data for Agriculture and Nutrition, also known as GORDAN. He began by discussing one of the challenges to be overcome.
One of the challenges with the knowledge generators is that oftentimes both the volume as well as the technical level of what they generate is a bit too remote from farmers' day-to-day reality. So part of our challenge is to work with both parties to identify the most relevant elements in a way that suddenly resonates with the farmers, that makes sense to them, and that is easy to use. Farmers don't need big data, but they need the fruits of big data to identify these pests that are harming their crops or their infestations that are also impeding what they're doing in farming.
How dependent on access to high technology or even computers is this transmission?
That's a very good question. In many emerging countries right now, I'm thinking of places like South Africa or Ethiopia, where you have these young startups that provide the benefits of precision agriculture to regular farmers and farmers associations. They provide maps of their farms, or their regions, indicating which part is infested or which part is too dry or which part needs fertilizers.
Part of the ethos of this fascinates me also, the idea that it's open. I mean, so much of the inequality between subsistence farmers and corporate or agricultural businesses is that they own all these satellites and have all this incredible information that is then not usually available to people on the ground who need it.
That's very true, because it's one thing to say that, oh, yeah, sure, satellite imagery is free and it's available, but not everybody can use it, really, because it's technically not so easy. That's why we have these intermediaries, all these often young, passionate people that are developing all kinds of open source tools to make it easily understandable and usable. Private companies, they make money. That's their reason for existing. So when they invest in research, they want to make sure that they recoup their investment.
André Laperriere is executive director of Gordon, a U.S., U.K., and U.N.-based NGO dedicated to open data sharing for the world's small farmers. He spoke with viewers Adam Phillips in New York. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with Football World Governing Body FIFA Awards 2020, which named Bayern Munich forward Robert Lewandowski the best FIFA men's player 2020. On Thursday, beaten off competition from last year's winner Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. Lewandowski, who won the German League and Cup double, as well as the Champions League with Bayern, finished as top scorer in all three competitions and won the award for the first time. The 32-year-old also led Poland to Euro 2020 qualification and was named the 2019-2020 UEFA Men's Player of the Year in October. No African player was named in the FIFA Pro World 11 men's team. And now to South Africa, where South African Football Association President Danny Jordan has provided some insight into when football fans can expect to return to stadiums following the COVID-19 enforced spectator ban. Last time a Premier Soccer League match in South Africa witnessed spectators was back in March 2020 before play was temporarily suspended due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Since then, spectators have not been allowed to attend games since the league's resumption in August. SAFA President Danny Jordan has since explained that a return to stadia for football fans remain unlikely until an effective vaccine is made available to the public, while the rising number of COVID-19 cases in South Africa will make the return all the more complicated.
It is an uncertain period, so I cannot tell you that from this day on the fans will be back in the stadium. But only thing that we can ask is let us observe the regulations and the rules that there. I think the next month or 2 months will be extremely tough for all of us as South Africans.
And now to West Africa, where Ghana and Burkina Faso reached the WAFU B Under 20 Championship Final, securing their place in the Total Under 20 African Cup of Nations Mauritania 2021. Both sides won their respective semifinals in the Benin-based championship earlier this week to set up a date in Sunday's final. The Black Satellites of Ghana booked their place after beating Niger 5-3 on penalties. Meanwhile, the Young Stallions of Burkina Faso sealed their final place after handing favorites Cote d'Ivoire a shocking 4-1 defeat at the same venue. And finally, in athletics, world record holder Kibiwot Kandi has his eyes set on representing Kenya at the Tokyo Olympics in 2021. This is despite the fact that Kibiwot Kandi's specialty, which is the half marathon, is not part of the Olympic roster. The 24-year-old is hoping to bring back the country's lost glory in the 10,000 race.
My target now is to work for Olympics come 2021, and I know I will make it through my hard work, perseverance, and more so discipline, and nothing impossible. In Olympics, I'll be looking to participate in 10,000, and I know I will make it.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, December 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.